Our next guest on Sunday Extra is the former arts editor of New Scientist magazine. He's written 8 novels and the non-fiction titles The Eye, A Natural History, and Stalin and the Scientists. And his latest book is called Engineers of Human Souls, 4 writers who changed 20th century minds. Those 4 writers are French nationalist Maurice Barre, the Italian poet who was the muse for Mussolini's fascism, Gabriel D'Annunzio, Maxim Gorky, who was very close to Stalin, and Maoist writer Ding Ling. And the 5th writer is the author of Engineers of Human Souls, Simon Ings. And I'm very pleased to say that he joins us on Sunday Extra now. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Could you remind us first, Simon, the pedigree of the title of your book, that phrase, Engineers of Human Souls, and give us a bit of a potted history of that one?
That phrase is supposed to have been cooked up by Joseph Stalin. It crops up quite a lot in the period, so we can't really assign it to one individual. The idea being that writers are politically useful, that they can promote new political ideas and new ways of social behavior. There was a famous dinner party in which everyone was frantically tugging their forelock to Joseph Stalin, and Stalin was flattering them greatly by calling them engineers of human souls. Wonderfully, also at the dinner party, there was what would be the equivalent in the Soviet Union of a 5-star general, who took great exception to the idea that writers could be more useful than tanks and guns.
You've chosen 4 writers who, as you say, changed 20th century minds, and each is an extraordinary life story. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover all of them in the time that we have, but I wonder if you could give us an overview of the really epic life of Ding Ling, who was born in 1904 and died in 1986. And it's fair to say that quite a bit went on in China while she was there.
Her life is really interesting, especially from a Western point of view, because whenever we associate words China and writer, we immediately reach for the word dissident. But surely writers are opponents of such a centralized and totalitarian regime. Ding Ling was a high-level bureaucrat. She worked her whole life to promote the Maoist project. In fact, she was promoting it long after Mao had died and long after the Chinese state had moved on from the Maoist period. She was an incredibly able writer who dedicated her talents to the promotion of a political idea. As a consequence, her literature suffered, her fiction suffered. She also fell foul of a movement called rectification, which didn't just swallow her, but swallowed almost every writer in the country. This was a movement to discipline members of the party, to get them all singing from the same hymn sheet, even during the civil war, even during the war with Japan, even during famine, even while they were probably quite likely to be stuck behind enemy lines. So there was a massive effort to regiment minds starting in about 1942, and she fell foul of that movement. And I think that's why we think of her as a victim of the regime. And indeed, she was, but she was also a massive prop to the regime. And at the end of her life, had inherited the nickname Old Shameful, because she would attack people for saying that Mao was old-fashioned, Mao's ideas had been blown somewhat, that the state has moved on. And she wasn't having any of it. Because the process of disciplining and regimenting her mind had actually made her unbreakable. It had toughened her up. It had given her a purpose. It had given her an identity that wasn't going to give way to anything, least of all history. So we have this extraordinary vision of this sensitive artist just becoming some kind of ideological tank that would just plow through history and plow through her own government, holding fast to ideas that she'd been effectively indoctrinated with, to the point where she didn't care what anyone thought, least of all the young writers that she was encouraging.
And the extraordinary thing, and really hard to get your head around, I find, is that despite what happened to her in her life and the suffering that she incurred at the very hands of the regime that she promoted, even that did not shake her belief.
It's extraordinarily touching to read what she said to her husband during the Cultural Revolution. We have to be a bit careful of the history here, because the process of rectification, which made her strong and made her into the image of a high-level Maoist bureaucrat took place in the 1940s. Years and years and years later, some of the same habits played out again during the Cultural Revolution, which was a much more chaotic period. And in that period, she says to her husband, effectively, forgive them because they do not know what they do. She becomes an almost Christ-like figure. She's loved. She's greatly admired in the town, who take political risks to try and restore her reputation. She becomes exactly what she was supposed to become, a selfless, almost Christ-like embodiment of the Maoist idea. So when the state becomes truly and horrifically pathological during the Cultural Revolution, she is almost the best that the state has to offer. And you can't help but admire it on a human level, because it enables her to survive and it enables her to be, in this horror show of history, essentially a good person.
That is extraordinary. And all this as well in circumstances where, as you suggest in the book, her first husband was in fact murdered by the Communist Party.
This didn't come out until years later. There was an intestine fight within the Communist Party. Well, I say fight, singular. Basically, the Communist Party split and split and split and split. One of these splits led to the arrest of a dozen teachers and low-level politicos within the communist movement. They were arrested by the British, handed over to the Kuomintang, the nationalist forces under Chiang Kai-shek, and were shot. And the fact that Ding Ling spends her entire life essentially working for the man who, unbeknownst to her, ordered the execution or enabled the execution of her husband is an irony that's hard to top. Perhaps the only way you can top it is to explain what happened to her in prison after the Cultural Revolution. She and her husband were thrown into prison, and that was probably a kindness, actually, because it kept them relatively safe during that period. Spent about a dozen years in prison, and she was living in a cell directly below the cell occupied by her husband and had no idea that that was the case. How do you explain these things unless you reach for an idea of extraordinary malevolence on the part of the state, or rather, extraordinary malevolence on the part of the culture that enables people to do that to each other? A lot of this book is about where political ideas become pathological. And we like to think of writers as the victims of that process, but quite often they're directing it, and they're certainly harnessed to it, and they're certainly promoted by it. Writers love to be useful, and you've got to watch that.
I was intrigued indeed by the reference in your book to the father of Ai Weiwei.
The father of Ai Weiwei was at the time, well, still is, a famous poet, and rightly so. And he condemned a friend of his in the most dehumanizing terms. But then everyone did. I mean, one of the aspects of criticism and self-criticism, which is part of the process by which you are psychologically remade by the party, it's not enough to keep quiet. It's not enough to say you're a good party member. You have to say where you've gone wrong. You have to admit error. You have to invent error in order to admit it. That process is incredibly powerful, but what it needs, a little extra, is a scapegoat. And so in the process of dehumanizing yourself, you're also dehumanizing others. And Ai Weiwei's father was absolutely part of that process, and that was ordinary. That was just what people did. It's certainly what Ding Ling did. She betrayed every close friend she ever had. And she had form as a young woman. I don't think Ding Ling was necessarily the pleasantest person on the planet, but she got really good at betrayal. She was taught.
We're speaking with Simon Ings, author of Engineers of Human Souls, Four Writers Who Changed 20th Century Minds. Simon, how is it that you became fascinated with the life of Ding Ling and then decided to pair it with Maurice Barr, Gabriel D'Annunzio and Maxim Gorky?
As a jobbing writer, I occasionally do a bit of coasting work, and I run into relatively wealthy people for about 5 minutes. You know, I have my Walter Mitty moment of kicking around the rich and famous, and then I go back to my hovel. And so I had a sort of subconscious or niggling interest in the relationship of writers and power. And the more I played with this idea, thinking to turn it into a fiction, the more I got interested in the political aspect. And then it was a question of trying to contain the idea in a way that would be friendly to the reader. So I ended up looking quite precisely and quite consciously at the 20th century. I knew that there were four great dictators I had to write about, and I was looking to see if there were writers that I could pair with them. D'Annunzio is very easy because Mussolini was his press agent for a number of years. Gorky was relatively easy because the West likes to think him as a victim and never understands, can never wrap its head around the fact that Gorky was pro-Stalin and supported Stalin in some of his most violent acts against the Russian people. Tingling was the gift of my brother, who studied Chinese. He was in the first airliner ever to visit communist China. He's a bit older than me. He's 12 years older than me. Well, he was in the first party of Western students ever to visit Beijing. And talking with him, he put me onto Tingling because she's not really known in the West. She's famous for one novel, On Sangam River, which comes to us as The Sun Rises Over Sangam River, because it needs our little, you know, oriental twist, and a handful of short stories. So it's not entirely surprising that we're not that familiar with her. But I think part of it is that in the West, we regard as more interesting the stories of dissidents, writers who criticize political power. They seem to have more drama to their lives. They seem to have more to say. They speak to our romantic ideas of the individual against the system. It's a narrative that we enjoy. In Tingling, we find a writer absolutely at the center of political power, trying to find a way, genuinely trying to find a way to use her talents in the promotion of a political idea. This naturally leads to her being artistically and politically compromised. But I hope that that story reveals that the role of the writer is not always that of the romantic hero. The writer can be an important and sometimes dangerous political figure.
The four lives are very different. You have brought them together. Do you think that they have particular character traits in common or challenges of circumstance in common? What unites them?
The first story I dealt with was that of Maurice Barre, who was a writer in search of a powerful figure, a dictator, if you like, to ally himself with. And I think through Barre, you get the common thread for all these four writers, which is that they want to represent the people. They genuinely want to embody some idea of the people. For Barre, it was ethnicity. He's the father of National Socialism, essentially, and at the late 19th century was coming up with the idea of the state defined by ethnicity, by race, essentially. And different as the other writers in the book are, they all have the idea of their writing somehow embodying the spirit of the people. And that's a natural thing for a writer to want to do, either when the state is collapsing around your ears, as was the case with Tingling in the early part of the 20th century. It's also true when you live in a working, perhaps democratic system, which feels as if it's not addressing people's concerns at all. This was the case of Maurice Barre, who was working at a time of the Third Republic, an extraordinarily shambolic political system that wasn't giving anything that anyone wanted to anybody, and did so for decade after decade after decade, and was looked on in the end as the great democratic success of the early 20th century. The thing about democracy is that it doesn't give what it promises. It never delivers on the day. What it can do, it can promise to deliver, do a little bit better tomorrow. It's always pushing its success onto the next day. Oh, we'll fix this. We'll fix these institutions. We'll get a more direct response for people tomorrow. And that can be very frustrating. And of course, it blew up in time for the First and certainly for the Second World War. So we have these writers wanting to somehow be the spiritual embodiment of their generation. Is that messianic? Absolutely. These are not people with small egos that I'm writing about here.
No, indeed. Is the lesson of your book something that can apply to the changing of 21st century minds, Simon?
There's an artistic argument that will hold for all time, which is that it doesn't matter what your politics is, the audience will always be able to detect insincerity. They smell insincerity a mile off. So the attempt to ally your work with someone else's political idea, however much you believe it, it will destroy your ability to write well. You will write in a way that just tastes dishonest to the reader or the audience. This was certainly true of Gorky's book, Mother, who, looking back, he said was the worst thing he ever wrote. And I think you can find plenty of examples today of attempts to express a political idea that fall flat on their face, not necessarily because the political idea is bad, but just because the attempt to fictionalize it leaves you with a huge gobbet of insincerity in your mouth. I mean, look at any recent Marvel Cinematic Universe movie for that. More broadly, I think the lessons are there, although they become a little bit muddied by the fact that we're now all little dinglings. We're all little Maurice Barres. We're all little Gabriella D'Annunzios. In our pocket, we have a little glass screen that enables us to express as extreme an opinion as we can come up with in a shorter time in order to get as many likes, which is essentially publicity. The phone is a publicity machine, and we all have them in our pockets. And so we live in a curious world in which we are all tinglings, all condemning each other. So the lessons from the book, I think, are surprisingly personal. This is what happened to four people who found themselves in the position of very uncertain and unpredictable political power. And it was quite hard to get into that position when they were working. And this is what happened to them. Well, guess what? That's you this morning. You are in that position this morning. You have the capacity to destroy your own lives, and especially your own, within a couple of hours.
And on that cheery note, we'll say thank you very much, Simon Ings. It's been great speaking with you.
It's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Simon Ings' new book is called Engineers of Human Souls, Four Writers Who Changed 20th Century Minds.
Getting in touch with ABC RN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.